Welcome to the Breaking Ground podcast. Join me, Steve Hadley, as I go on a virtual journey around the globe exploring the career history of our guest, prominent geotechnical engineer, Derek Pennington. That's up after our sponsor's message.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Often these podcasts focus on particular topics like sustainability, news items or technical information, but every now and then I like to take time to take a deep dive into someone's career history. When we do that, it can be really interesting and inspiring. And today's guest is someone that I've only just got to know. In fact, he got in touch as a fan, as a listener of the show. And I knew once I spoke to him that I had to share his story. My only worry is how we fit it all into an hour's podcast. But welcome, Derek Pennington.
Thanks, Steve. Lovely to be here.
Good stuff. I think you're possibly our first international guests, certainly the first person that's overseas when they're recording. That's a fantastic thing because it shows the reach of the podcast, and I think it will help connect with more people in Australia and, of course, South Africa, where I'm sure you've still got many friends and contacts and where you were brought up. And in fact, you were born during growing up during the apartheid era, which must have been very challenging in itself. I know that you're a liberal person, and I think South Africa clearly has come a long way. But at that moment in time, it must have been a very difficult place to live. You had an interesting journey into geotechnics. In fact, it didn't really start there. Do you want to explain to the listeners where your first degree was? And then we can explore that path into geoscience.
Okay. Well, growing up in South Africa, there was no such thing as free university education. And the way to get there was via a bursary. And the proponents of bursaries tended to be those who were at the big end of town. And I managed to land one with De Beers Diamonds. And to be as industrial diamonds, and that got me to University of Cape Town, where I studied mechanical engineering.
And your focus subsequent to your mechanical engineering degree was actually on diamonds cutting and actually making fake diamond. A diamond, I think I'm right in saying, is effectively coal that's been put under a huge amount of pressure and changes shape. But De Beers, and it's not just De Beers, they've actually got a process now, and presumably been around for some years, where you can make that artificially rather than go into a mine and do it. And you were involved in the process of coming up with the machinery to create that. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was finessing the equipment. I won't say I was made it. The first started making these absolutely genuine diamonds in the 1960s. The decade I was born, but it was getting better and better at doing it that I was then involved in, was helping to finesse the systems that got bigger and bigger, so that the capsules, which we are subject to up to 60 gigapascals of pressure, were initially very small, sub-centimetre, whereas by the time I was involved in that, we were up to close to a 10-centimetre capsule. Which you could obviously make a lot more diamond in. So it was hard to create those high-pressure systems and make them slightly more sustainable than the smaller ones. Though I have subsequently learned that you don't need the pressure anymore. You can make real diamond by just floating methane gas over a substrate at the right temperature and conditions, and you can grow them slowly without all the pressure involved there. So, you know, technology has moved on somewhat.
So you actually grow them, you don't, there's no pressure involved, it's just more of a chemical process rather than a physical process now.
I was only looking on YouTube yesterday about it, so I don't know the full details, but I thought, better prepare for the oddball question from you. And
well, you'll be forgiven for not being an expert in something you were looking at in your early 20s. But the quality of the diamond, the size of the diamond, potentially could be as good as something you would find in the ground.
Absolutely. Right? Chemically and physically, it's exactly the same.
Same
properties altogether.
Wow.
I think in all the... the ongoing discussion about blood diamonds and the bad side of the diamond industry, the opportunity is now to be able to grow in a laboratory-type environment diamonds that are literally the same looking as the other diamonds that people might want to wear on their fingers.
Yeah, that can really only be a positive if we can take all of those issues away. Although, I suppose there is a risk that... if they're so plentiful, will people actually want diamonds? you've got to manage the supply of them, haven't you? It's not just the beauty of a diamond that is attractive. It's the availability of it. And
absolutely, that's what I learned later on in my career when going to work for De Beers. It was, you know, just how they controlled the release of these diamonds onto the market to make them rare and to manage very carefully the value of something which really didn't have any intrinsic value like that at all.
Well, I don't know if this is an urban myth, but there was always a story knocking around about some beach in South Africa that De Beers owned, and the beach was awash with diamonds, but nobody was allowed on this beach because they'd go on there and pick up all the diamonds, and then the price of diamonds would plummet. Is that a load of rubbish?
Yes, that's down near a river mouth called Aronjemund on the Namibia-South African border, where that rather large river comes down from the Kimberlite quartz, the Kimberlite pipe, where most of the biggest diamonds have come from. So yes, it's all just a case of geology doing what it must do and bringing diamonds down to the sea and then spreading them along amongst the sea sand along the coast, which was very highly protected as essentially a militarized zone to prevent people from going to pick diamonds up on the beach.
Wow. Gosh. Yes, it must be tempting, you know, given some of the poverty there that people would want to take advantage of that. So, still with De Beers, you moved to Cambridge to do an MPhil. In fact, it was going to be a doctorate, wasn't it? I think at the outset, De Beers had sponsored you to do that in soil mechanics.
No, De Beers sponsoring stopped after the mechanical engineering, and it was a case of trying to patch together a number of scholarships to get to Cambridge. And I had done another master's before getting there as well, which was in applied mechanics and writing finite element code for civil engineering applications. And I guess that was what I wanted to go and do at Cambridge and do it within the soil mechanics environment.
The
dream was to do the PhD. The reality was that I only had enough scholarship for 1 year. So there was always going to be a hitch somewhere along the line.
Yeah, it came at a time that I think you explained that the rand against the pound fell dramatically.
I think it was about 300%, yes. became essentially worthless.
So your bursary was worthless. And that really forced you off the academic side into industry. So with this newly furnished desire for soil mechanics and maybe some issues in terms of the integrity of the diamond industry, you headed off to Arup Geotechnics and begged them for a job. Is that right?
It's about like it. So I phoned June Britton up, who ran the company. She was Martin Stroud's personal assistant, I think you might say, but in fact she ran Arup, and somehow told them that they needed to give me a chat and a chance anyway, and that became a really lovely story of in excess of 13 years in the end, I think, with Arup.
Yeah, I know you really enjoyed your time there. What sort of projects were you working on in the early years?
Oh, my very first project was a car park in Croydon, down the south. I remember feeling terrified at the thought of even logging a test pit and trying to turn this into some engineered design. So, there was some very lowly starts in there. I think the absolute highlight was being one of the four leads on the site investigations for Crossrail in 1992s, 3s. Which was incredibly exciting to be running with an amazing team. I think what was the largest site investigation ever done in Britain, or the most costly, I should say, at that period in time.
Well, that just shows the amount of time it takes, the gestation period for these major projects, doesn't it, that you were involved in 92, but probably the majority of the ground engineering work didn't happen for sort of 10 or 15 years. I can't remember the date that most of the Crossrail was completed, but probably 2010, 2015, between those sorts of periods.
Absolutely. A long time. There was an idea of Jim Johnson's, who was well up in the Arup management at this stage too, to have a get-together at 25 years, but I think it still hadn't opened, so that's passed and we're yet to do it.
So you've done a lot on SI work. You'd also worked on gravity suction foundations during that period as well. Do you want to explain a little bit about the concept
of that those? I guess my approach to life in Arup was to put my hand up whenever there was a job somewhere remote going on. The first opportunity was to go and do investigations for the Gorgon project off the northwest shelf of Australia, and I was given the opportunity to review two North Sea jobs one morning, and that made me an expert. Ha ha! And off we went. So the initial aspect was really just the site investigation, but then that moved fairly quickly into very detailed laboratory design for a gravity base platform. And then related to that was a move into the ACE platform, which is a suction foundation solution that was developed by some wonderful structural engineers at Arup. And the first one was the West Natuna project, which was which I was involved in installing up in the South China Sea, just a few tens of kilometres north of Singapore. Yeah. And that was manufactured in the Hyundai shipyard, floated down, and they come with their own deck, which they use to float on as lowering their foundations to the seabed and sucking into the seabed, and then jacking the deck up out of the water on the legs to end up with a platform that hasn't needed any particular attendance of very large and expensive support vessels.
Okay, so the foundations are on the bottom of this rig set up, and it's just floated into position, dropped down, and it literally does what it says on the tin. It sucks into the ground. And
the art somewhere in there is to get the pumping rates right in the different cells so that you're not failing the soil and sucking it all through the pump systems. You have to replace the water that's in the upturned buckets or cups at just the right rate that you're installing, and to achieve an overall balance and to achieve a level platform and so on. That, as you can imagine, is a little bit more technical than most geotechnical foundation installation projects where, and again, to me, that was the fascination and the joy of having done mechanical engineering, was to be right over all those pumping systems and right over designing and overseeing the control system so that we'd get that right and be able to have the assurance that all the instrumentation needed to tell you were in the right place, you were at the right depths, and that you could then, with assurance, start jacking the deck out of the water with the assurance that you had sufficient foundation capacity at that stage. Because these these locations, the soil strength is would leave you eye-wateringly sad, given your piling business. We're talking about sub 5 kPa shear strength. You're working just on a whim and some luck that you've got a sufficient area mobilized to be able to get a secure foundation in those environments.
These things are they're filled with water initially to help it sink into the ground.
They're simply an upturned cup pointing downwards, if you were, and so you. When you start floating off the barge, yes, you have to. They get carried down on a heavy lift vessel because they're a bit slow to tow a long distance on their own deck. So it's probably the only last day or two that they're floating on their own deck. But yes, you have to pump and evacuate all the air out of those upturned caissons first, so that it's secure, and then slowly lower it down, and then. Once it's on the seabed, you have to pump that water out of them as you replace the water with soil.
To weigh it down. Okay. Yeah. And there's a difference, though, isn't there, between the platforms for drilling to find out if there is any, or to the production rigs? There's you wouldn't use the same platform for both. So these, that presumably one needs to be a fairly light duty solution, so you can try it in one spot over here, see if there's any oil, pick it up, go and do it somewhere 500 meters across the seabed.
Yeah, so the ones I was talking when I went on to be involved in two or three of them are essentially production platforms. So they wouldn't come kitted with the whole drilling rigs that are needed to drill 10 kilometers into the ground or something like that. That's a very much more specialist device, and those platforms, well, they are a platform in their own right, would come alongside and generally lift themselves up and spread over your production platform and then drill down through the wellhead conduits that you want eventually to have the connectors with the great pipes that go into the ground. And they would then drill from there, and then once they've done their job, they lift themselves up and take themselves off and off into the sunset.
Interesting.
And then you then kit out the platform to be that primary production unit, which then exports either via pipeline or to tankers or to floating storage units, whatever.
And it's the same drilling equipment, whether you're looking for gas or oil. Do you get both simultaneously, or is that just completely different setups?
No, I learned all this on the job. It's as you can imagine, each resource comes in different with different characteristics. The one I was involved in, which was really a career most notable project, was the Maori project down off New Zealand. And that's a very waxy crude gas. So you can imagine that unless you kept the well warm, the wax would just block everything. So there they had to put heaters 5 kilometres down the wells to keep the crude oil sufficiently liquid to be able to then pump it up to the surface. So you can imagine the complexity of putting heaters 5 kilometers down a hole, and then keeping that crude oil in a condition where it could then be safely, actually be pumped and exported for need, for use.
It all sounds extremely hazardous. I'm sure it is. That's why there's all those controls, safety controls within the oil and gas industry, but
it was in the late 1990s. It was a very attractive industry to go and work in because the budgets were large and you could do things properly, that was very exciting to be able to spend money doing the sorts of lab testing. You know, you would just cry with delight at being able to do a lab testing budget of $10 million for one project. And to be able to do complex cyclic testing, to be able to do flume studies, to do all sorts of centrifuge works, modeling work that you're testing your concepts on, that you're, all these suction bucket foundations, they were world firsts. So there was a lot of time spent in the centrifuge just modeling exactly how that was all going to work, and being using that to then predict what was going to happen when you actually went and did it for real.
Now, during your time at ARUP, you were honoured as being the first winner of the John Mitchell Award. Before we perhaps talk about the paper, could you just explain to the listeners who John was and how the award came about?
John was the most fantastic mentor to have as a relative, well, a very green geotechnical engineer in ARUP. He was a member of our group. He was not the group leader, but he was a senior person within that, and had an amazing ability to just see problems and to see solutions. And so he was in our team as one of the more senior members there. But on some day, and I forget which year and exactly, it might have been
1989, according to the BGA website. Yeah.
I was the one who took a call from site to say that John had had a very bad accident, and we needed to get through with the business of dealing with that news. And yes, he had fallen down a pile.
Hole.
There was no hope.
Well, I can only imagine how upsetting that would have been. In honour of John, the ICE and the BGA created the award, which is aimed at celebrating geotechnical practice, and it's still running. You can still enter. I'm not sure the dates for this year, but it's a submission of a paper. Is it open to all engineers?
I think it is now. Initially, it was only for young geotechnical engineers, just, I think, to reflect John's passion for passing on learning. And it was to submit a paper on some foundation work. There was obviously a focus towards that being piled foundations, given the context of John's death. And the prize wasn't just cash. The prize, part of the competition, and I don't know if that is still part of it, was to devise the world tour of your dreams to visit geotechnical sites of interest and people that you wanted to have a chance to meet. So it was not only writing a paper, but it was devising a travel plan that had to inspire the judges to consider you further.
Brilliant. And what was your paper on, and where were you planning to go on this this world tour of geotechnical sites? And did you go?
The paper,
that was more importantly.
Oh, absolutely. The paper was based on a fantastic opportunity I had to work in Bangkok for a year or so. And that was for what was called the BERTS project, Bangkok Elevated Road and Train System, which was a massive Hadrian's type wall of three train lines and six motorway lines, all on one big elevated structure to go across the city. And this needed some serious foundations. Many will know that Bangkok has got some of the softest soils on the globe, and they're deep. They could be 40 metres deep of the soft soil. So finding a piled solution when over 20,000 piles of large diameter were needed meant an opportunity. I think it was 17 full-size trial piles we did in the end. And those are trial piles up to 2.5 metres in diameter and 60, 70 metres in length, fully instrumented and loaded with some of the most amazing triple gantried anchored load frames you could imagine, and to carry out as it was a number of techniques to look at. Shaft grouting was one, or base grouting to preload the piles, to redevelop them. And one of the aspects that in interpreting that these that I came across and tried to then write about was evidence of just what happened with the grout when you cracked these piles, and then tried to increase shaft friction by grouting. And that was an amazing bit of luck that came out of all the observations. And that was just showing that simply by putting a fully reinforced concrete pile in the ground of those sorts of dimensions, and then letting the concrete cool and obviously gain its strength, is that the shrinkage, which is entirely predictable but probably not often thought about, the shrinkage resulted in the pile cracking itself as the top pulled against the base, and you ended up with fairly significant cracks. And we got evidence of this cracks, real evidence, and where these strain gauges had actually picked up this concrete pulling itself apart. So you would end up in a pile which might have an amazing base capacity, but it also had a gap of 10 millimetres or so halfway down it, which had to be recompressed as you brought load on from the top, because the bottom had pulled from the top.
So the is this because as the concrete was going off so quickly, because it was such a big pile, the bottom couple of loads of concrete in the ground have gone off, and then you've got a cold joint almost with the upper?
No, not at all. I think the cracking probably only occurred, you know, after day 28, somewhere far down the line, when the shrinkage, the load was, I don't remember the actual data, but the timelines are in there. You know, we're pretty sure that the pile had, you know, done some of its curing, and there would have been no, you know, cold cracks or anything, or cold joints like that.
Yeah.
This was simply, you were developing such force due to the ongoing long-term shrinkage of that pile that you were pulling the pile apart as part of it pulled against the other part of it that was deeper in the ground.
Gosh. And presumably the way to get around that is put reinforcement within the full depth of the pile.
Oh, the being trial piles, these were all fully reinforced because we had to have things to hang all the instrumentation off. So even a reinforced pile, there was evidence of cracking occurring.
So what do you do? How do you solve it?
Well, it wasn't. This is just something which remains of academic interest. I don't think anyone does. You just live with it.
Right.
It's you know, that was what the paper was, really. It was just a look at something which doesn't really find its way into any piling code or anything else. It's just a chance of some interesting observation.
Mm. Okay. Well, hopefully most of the buildings are still standing. Presumably that part of the world, there's also concerns regarding the earthquake seismic activity as well.
Yeah,
into your research still.
Yeah, and no, earthquake really didn't come into that. It was obviously huge allowance for negative skin friction, just Bangkok has settled 2, 3, 4 meters in parts over time as groundwater has been abstracted. So that tends to add a lot more excitement to all the pile design there as well.
Yeah. Okay.
And so then worked up a little travel plan, which included a bit of time in Hong Kong, Shanghai, Beijing, Tokyo, and giving a lecture on the project in Japan as well at University of Kyoto.
And that was all funded by the award?
Yep.
Okay. Very generous. Okay, I don't know what the what the award value is these years, but hopefully it's still sufficient to support such a great journey.
I have to admit, the geotechnical community who welcomed me around there were incredibly generous. In Japan, having given this essentially a seminar stroke lecture, I was handed a thick envelope at the end of it. Thank you for coming. Just such incredible generosity, and with time and with everything.
It's a country that I've well, I've always wanted to visit. I think watching the Olympics this year has made me even keener to venture there at some point. Hopefully I'll get the chance. So it may be inspired by your experience in Japan of lecturing at the seminar. You moved into the academic community and started lecturing at Bristol University.
Yes, again, that was another opportunity with I forget what it's called now, but it was an industrial grant award that you could do a PhD at the same time as being paid to contribute to the university under a research program. And I was lucky enough to get that award and go out to Bristol and work with David Nash and Martin Lings on some incredibly interesting work of looking at shear waves in clays, in geomaterials, really. The project kind of grew from there. I guess the most rewarding part of it was eventually inventing, in inverted commas, bender element devices that would measure anisotropy within triaxial cells and carry out these very long-term, very small strain tests on, say, samples of the Galt clay, which I'd managed to collect from Cambridge using rather large Sherbrooke sampler, and then run a laboratory, again using a lot of the mechanical engineering skills I'd learnt and worked on, and actually running a laboratory which was so well temperature controlled and so well understood with the very slow rate pumps and the very slow rate strain controlled to enable this very low small strain stiffnesses to be tested not only using shear waves but also in loading rates in the laboratory.
Derek, can you explain how your academic research was relevant in the industrial world?
Well, I think the first exciting thing is that it had come out of the industrial world and had real applications in London. We'd had a few years before Brian Simpson giving his Rankine lecture on the brick model and showing just how path and small strain was important in the way in which we then modelled deformation in the soil. Then this was to really extend the actual knowledge in way in which you could measure in the laboratory what the properties would be of different geomaterials. So one of the projects I actually tested my newly devised equipment for real on was the Millennium Tower in London, which was about to be rebuilt. And that was a case of spending some time in London on samples of the Thanet beds that were being brought up and actually looking at the cross-anisotropy of those samples and then feeding that back into the design work that my colleagues at AREP were doing. And I guess the interest has continued, not with me doing it anymore, but so many other authors have gone on to write about this. And even today, I get notification of being cited for the work that was done 25 years ago as starting off a lot of this interest in anisotropy of very small strain stiffness.
I'm sure that's really rewarding. And you've also managed to squeeze in other rewarding activities like you work with Red-R over the years. I know that's been at various different points of your career. And so Red-R, for people that aren't aware, is a group called the Register of Engineers for Disaster Relief. They were formed in the UK, but they draw on engineering professionals from around the world to work on humanitarian projects. Derek, tell us about a couple of projects that you've worked on.
Well, there was obviously a lot of training in the UK to prepare one for this sort of work. Yeah, one has to be very careful of thinking you know everything and be sent out to the disaster areas and then become more of a burden to the people you're supposedly helping than what you should be. My first trip with Red-R was to Afghanistan in the early 1990s. In the company of a Brigadier General, retired Brigadier General of the British Army, and the BEESO, British Executive Services Overseas, funded the work, but called on Red-R for help in the form of an engineer. And that was to look at reconstruction after the Russians had withdrawn from Afghanistan in those early days. So that work was anything from hospital services through to some hydroelectric dams, and really just being the eyes and ears with an engineering bent towards helping funders put money in as part of that reconstruction event. The second one was very different. It was up on the Rwandan border in Tanzania a couple of years later in 1999. And it was ostensibly a failed hydroelectric scheme again. But when it came down to it on the ground, it was really just a failure of European funders to do the right thing and ask for the same right due diligence, and most of the money had found its way into the pockets of various religious bishops in Tanzania, and the project had failed because of starvation of funding. But still a very rewarding thing to be able to pick it up and help that get back on track.
Is it open to sort of all levels of engineers to support a course like that if you wanted to get involved?
Yes, I mean, I can remember on the training courses we did in the UK, up in Yorkshire and around, there'd be people from all engineering walks of life, certainly not just university educated otherwise, because often, you know, what you need is people who are really practical and could actually do things. Yeah. So, you know, the trade route or the tech route was very highly valued. Yes. As well, and that was the nice thing about it is that one was working across a whole lot of far more practical situations than anything particularly intellectual. It was hard to actually be useful in an environment where you don't have access to all the usual things you might have in your usual working life, and how to be innovative, how to get solutions that help people, particularly in those disaster recovery type environments.
Yeah, it certainly inspired me to go and find out more. I'm not sure I'll be sent to Afghanistan anytime soon. It's terrible what's happening there at the moment, and let's hope that over the next few years things can settle down and they can find some peace within that country. And your benevolent work still continues now. You're living in Australia, but you're still doing volunteering work. You mentioned to me about some work that you've done with sports pitches, for instance, and that's quite a local level in Tasmania, is that right?
But that was actually when living in Western Australia and working out of Perth with a friend who actually supplied the AstroTurf and tennis courts, bowling greens and the likes, and finding out from him just what the issues were of not really of clubs in the rural areas really not being having the wherewithal to have proper geotechnical investigations, and then the projects falling on their heads again, and so we used to share trips, share vehicles, and essentially go and do pro bono work in the country, working out what was actually needed to make these sports clubs viable and to make sure they had decent courts to play on.
So it just shows what a varied experience you can have as a geotechnical engineer. And there's so many things that we've mentioned about your career history already. I've barely touched on your time in Australia, because you went to Australia to start up Arup Geotechnics. So you'd re-engaged with Arups and went there. And I know you then moved on and subsequently started Wally Geoscience, which have become a huge global company. And you were involved in some pretty big projects with them as well. And you mentioned there was a large scheme you're involved with, which actually ultimately went to litigation, that was quite interesting, and that was around self-installing platforms, which it looped back round to your early part in your career. Well, what was the actual problem on that particular scheme?
So that was the Mari project. So I'd left ARA some time before, and in fact left Worley Parsons and had a spell with Advanced Geomechanics, now Fugro. And as a, just a, an independent engineer, I managed to get in and assist with the development of this offshore platform for New Zealand, the one I mentioned with the very waxy crude oil, and was essentially client's representative for nearly 5 years, right from the offshore investigation and using a new tool, the PROD, the remotely operated drill that had been developed at the University of Sydney and now operates out of Houston in Texas and other places around the world. And we'd used that to design this pretty innovative foundation. But when it came to installation, and I was then back with my colleagues from Arup, though I now represented the client, and we had the contractors team in there as well. There's a lot of pressure because you've got a huge team mobilised. We were in a bay, Admiral Bay, in the north of South Island of New Zealand, and I think at one stage there were 18 vessels all lined up doing various tasks to get this platform ready for sailing out to the site. And weather was very dicey. Large seas there, I think we'd designed for something like a 24.5 meter wave. So you're designing foundations that have got to take some pretty large battering. And then the instrumentation, as I mentioned previously, was really quite complex. So there was tilt meters here, there and everywhere. There would have been sensors, load sensors on the strand jacks. There would have been nearly 600 cable strands that had to be used and as in lowering the foundation to the seabed and then raising the upper part. Anyway, in the way these things happened, there was a small weather window which closed rather more quickly than wanted, and some of the pre-checks didn't happen. And as the base was lowering towards the seabed, it appeared the whole deck was tilting. And to correct the tilt, we were jacked more on the other side and tried correcting it, and things just got worse and worse until it was realized that the angle, the tilt centers were 180 degrees out of phase, and they were telling us the opposite from what was actually happening. And you just simply cannot believe that on such an expensive project, such a small surveying mistake could actually happen.
Yeah.
And what this caused was the skirts, they found the suction buckets to make a big gouge across the seabed just where you were wanting to install them, and to get a perfect marrying at that exact location, which had been perfectly site investigated. And as a result of this too, we ended up pumping too fast. We failed the soil inserting the skirts, the sea then became rough, and that surged the platform, and great big holes formed around these caissons, which were now burying themselves into the seabed. And yes, managed to get the platform out of the water and stable, but we had no idea how much factor of safety we had left in our foundation, whether it was even safe just to stay on deck.
Gosh.
It had got that close.
Pretty
that
scary.
We all knew exactly where the lifeboats were, because at this stage too, you can imagine this, the friction sliding pads between the lowering the mast that gets lowered to the seabed and the deck is not designed for huge movements when you've got the waves riding through at that sort of pace. And it really sounded like the thing was going to break itself apart.
Gosh. Yeah, usually as geotechnical engineers, we're quite isolated from our works. but, you're literally there your life is at risk.
Yeah. So another month of offshore operations ensued with what, should have been just a day to install the platform. And that was trying to recover the foundation by, first of all, placing sandbags, trying to, because of course we'd lost suction, so we hadn't managed to suck the foundation as far into the seabed as needed, so we had to devise all sorts of additional techniques, using the equipment we had. Equipment started failing on that time because it had only been designed to do a temporary installation, and now we were pushing it to the lengths of its what it was capable of working out in that environment. And so, yes, had to have other supporting vessels and things, and the bill ran up into the hundreds of millions in excess of what was anticipated with a simple install. And very many lessons to be learnt in that. And as you mentioned, it then went through to litigation, and ultimately, fortunately, a negotiated agreement was made for an undisclosed sum of money.
Well, we certainly learn a lot as engineers from FIDA, as much as we obviously try and avoid it. Now, I know, as I mentioned at the introduction, you're a fan of the podcast, and one of the reasons we got connected was you were touched by one of the early podcasts that I did with Richard, Jyoti and Fiona on LGBT issues, and you've had your own journey with that, Derek. I know you want to share with the listeners a little bit about that, because it's so important to share those stories and give confidence to other people that are out there and perhaps need some support and need some confidence.
Yes, have we got another 3 hours? It's in my case. Yes, I knew I was gay from being a young child, but simply couldn't do anything about it, and so lived the first 55 years of my life totally denying anything to do with what my actual sexuality was, and trying to survive that, resulting in being on antidepressants for 23 years of my life, suffering an awful lot of pain, and eventually only, as I said, 3 to 4 years ago, reluctantly being brought out, I guess, initially by being caught with doing what one does when you're away as a geotechnical engineer or working for long periods of time, and that is finding relief where you best can find it. And ultimately enjoying the support of my daughters, who were the ones who really outed me publicly, not through any malice, but through being very proud of having a gay dad. The story from that side was very nice. Obviously, it was anything but nice for my dear wife, and that journey is still going on for her, whereas I'm fortunately in the happiest place I've ever been, really, and just being fully myself and learning just how much of an impediment that really has been in what one brings to work, if you just can't bring your whole self.
Yeah.
And that you've put yourself through all this turmoil of hiding what you are, and spending so much energy and so much time trying to hide and tell yourself that you're not worth being around because you're a pervert, or you haven't a clue what you how to be yourself. So it's been a real wonderful journey to be able to bring that fully openly to the workplace now, as much as anywhere else in life.
Yeah, well, that's great to hear that you're in a good place with that. You've worked in so many different environments and over a relatively long period of time. How would you contrast those different working environments, those different cultures between countries, and how has that evolved over the period from your perspective as a gay man, albeit not an out gay man, for a lot of that time?
Well, I guess the early days in South Africa were pretty traumatic. Came from a very religious family, grew up in an incredibly homophobic environment, where there was only one thing worse than being a communist, and that was to be a gay communist. And I would have been on that side of politics in the South African scene. But it was just the absolute conservatism of the family I grew up in. I have relatively recently, and well after his death, got pretty much the clear feeling that my father was gay as well, and was went through an awful lot of treatment to correct his sins, and that probably had a lot to do with his early death, ultimately.
So you're talking about chemical treatments that were in place at the time. In fact, I think are still being used around the world, these corrective therapies that some communities think can move gay people back to being heterosexual.
Absolutely. It's only been outlawed in Tasmania, where I live now, last year. There's still some parts of Australia who haven't yet come out against that, and of course huge number of states in the US where it's still legal to apply corrective therapies. They probably wouldn't be the physical ones these days as much, they tend to be more psychological, but I'm sure there are many places in the world where the physical ones are still used, and that could range from shock treatment, very much higher shock voltages than would be used in most corrective medical depression type environments. The pills, the treatment with heavy metals essentially, or with lithium, all things just to try and reduce the libido to nothing, so that there was nothing to talk about, and you could continue your life without a libido and without any desire to be yourself.
I must admit, and I don't think I'll be alone in this, I've had very little awareness of these therapy. It seems the wrong word, therapy, because therapy tends to suggest something positive, and this is anything but. But I certainly wasn't aware of these procedures that were out there. Open my eyes.
Quick Google of YouTube on conversion therapy, and there's fortunately a lot of stories now which debunking it and giving the positive stories of people who managed to survive it and come through it. But yes, it's been prevalent right up to the present.
Well, Derek, thank you for allowing us to explore your personal journey, and it's been an honour the last hour to hear about your technical exploits and achievements. Feels a little bit like I've been back to university for a lecture. I've learned so much, and thank you for bearing with me when I've at times not quite understood some of the concepts, but I promise to find out more, and I'm sure all of the listeners will have been hooked on all of your words. So thank you so much for today, and I look forward to remaining in contact and remaining friends, and perhaps getting in touch with some of your network in Australia and overseas as well.
Oh, many thanks, Steve. Pleasure is all mine. As I said to you when I first sent you an email, I just cannot believe that our industry has come this far forward, that you have a discussion which ranges so widely beyond just what we do in the ground. It really is heartening that humanity has come to our profession in a big way.
Thank you for listening. One last thing before you go. We're always looking for new guests and new topics on this podcast. So if you have some ideas, please send them across to my LinkedIn address.